Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Alberto Alvarez is an investor that has been scouring the commodity space for a while. He invested in Uranium Juniors from 2017 to 2021. I found Alberto through his Substack, where he wrote about Ero Copper, ticker symbol ERO. I don't own it, but obviously I'm a big copper bull. And then we started DMing, and he wrote a big piece on palladium and platinum group metals and that whole ordeal. And I just, you know, put one and one together and said, all right, Alberto is somebody I want to follow, I want to interact with. And, you know, so we've been in touch ever since. And I thought, what better way to get other people familiar with him than to bring him on the podcast and talk about what he likes to research. So Alberto, thanks for coming on. And for those that don't know who you are or what you do, give us a background on how you got started investing and what led you to the commodity space in general.
Hi, thank you for having me. My background, in terms of education, I have a degree in accounting and I have two master's degrees. I have a master's degree in value investing and another one in computer science in big data. When it comes to investing, I started investing when I was 14 years old. I started pretty early. Basically I went full time, I would say, when I was about like 20 years old. Since I found about uranium and I dived like really deep into the thesis. I would say that like my commodity market experience started back then, back in 2017. And since then, I have been focusing pretty much on commodities. Although after 2021, 2022, I sold all my uranium stocks decided to also focus on deep value and asymmetric opportunities in the stock market.
You were pretty early in the uranium game, starting in 2017. I feel like a lot of people, myself included, were later stage. I mean, late stage, depending on who you ask, right? This could be the early stage still, but 2017 is early by far. I mean, it was basically you and Mike Alkin and a couple other guys. So what did you see in uranium back then that made you bullish that now everyone else seems to think is obvious?
I mean, like, first of all, like, I was like completely wrong. Like from 2017 to 2020, I lost like 50% of my money. I was dead wrong in terms of timing. Actually, it was luck. I was at that time, I was really focused on silver and gold, because both had almost like bottomed in 2016. And I was listening to some gold mining conference on YouTube, and suddenly on YouTube, it popped up, hey, would you like to listen to some uranium miner conference? And I was like, why not? And these guys were talking about suffering the worst time of their lives. And the thesis just made sense. There were every uranium producer was selling uranium below production cost. And that made no sense. And even back then, nuclear energy made a lot of sense to me. And after that day, I listened to a few more conferences, and I listened to Rick Rule from Sprott Inc.
Yep.
And he's a firm believer in uranium. And I don't know, everything just clicked. Unfortunately, my timing, as I was saying, was horrible. I went through really tough times back then.
So you go from 2017 to 2021 to riding this crazy uranium wave. At some point, you stumble into copper and Ero Copper. So walk me through how you found the copper thesis, why it made sense to you, and then let's dive into the company specifically, because I think it's an interesting little asset.
Yeah. So in 2022, I decide to sell everything uranium because equity prices were just way above my fair value estimates. If you want, we can dive a bit deeper into that. But since you asked about copper, copper was nowhere near as an interesting of an opportunity as uranium. It wasn't trading, or it isn't trading below production cost. That said, it is trading below incentive price. At these prices, no one in their right mind would bring on a big copper project outside, the DRC or countries like that, where permitting is super straightforward. So for me, copper shares many similarities with uranium. Both are in great need in the electrification of the world, and they have no substitute. If you want to electrify anywhere, any place, anything, you need copper. So in that sense, the thesis of the metal made a lot of sense. Also, as I was pointing out in my Substack, in my first article about Ero Copper, copper mines are getting deeper and deeper, and the deeper they get, the costlier it gets to run these mines and to actually find them. Also, the environmental cost is massive. Because you need to employ a lot more electricity to take the copper out. Also, the grades since 1990 have dropped 75% in the average copper mine in the world, especially in Chile, which is the number one producer of copper in the world. About Ero Copper, I found Ero Copper through some geologists that were talking about it on YouTube, and at the beginning I was a bit suspicious about it, not about the company itself, but just the fact that it's so big. From my time in uranium, I was invested in really small caps companies that were trading, below $100 million, below $50 million in market cap. So for me, investing in a company that has a market cap of $2 billion, $3 billion was just out of my lane. But when I started to dive deeper into Eric Copper, it seems like a really, really interesting company. It has one of the lowest cost of production in the world. It's on the top 3% of emissions in terms of like CO2 emissions when it comes to copper production. And their new project, Boa Esperança, which now is called Tucuma, has a massive IRR, and it's going to come into production this year, in fact, in between July and December, and it's going to achieve commercial production in 2025. But possibly the best thing about Ero Copper isn't about like the low cost of production or even the doubling in production in the near term. For me, the fact that they have their own exclusive pipeline to the water reservoir nearby and to the hydroelectric plant, it's incredible. Like, I don't know of any other copper miner, or for that fact, any other miner that has that kind of infrastructure.
So you find this company, and I think the interesting thing about copper miners in general, really any sort of mining stock, is a lot of these numbers and valuations and things will look not great on like a trailing month basis or a trailing 12 month, because ideally the way to play some of these cycles is you find something like an Ero Copper where they're bringing new production online and production's going from, you know, just making up numbers, 100,000 ounces, or, you know, in copper's terms, call it 100 million pounds to 200 million pounds, 300 million pounds. Yeah. And that's really kind of the wave you want to catch there. But walk me through kind of the valuation method you use for something like an Ero Copper. Do you go kind of mine by mine? What assumptions do you bake into all-in sustaining costs in terms of inflation and then just like sustaining CapEx and things like that, that obviously affect cash flows?
So in terms of production, for Ero Copper in particular, I take two scenarios. I take their current copper production and I take their doubling production. You know, they're going from 50,000 tons to 100,000 tons. So in terms of valuation, I take those two scenarios. In terms of price, in terms of cost, sorry, I take their costs from 2022, which are the ones that have the massive inflation baked in.
Okay.
The good thing about Ero Copper is that they have been very, very conservative in terms of their approach in taking debt into the company and the cost of that debt. So, for example, they issued $150 million in debt in, I think it was January 2022, just before the war in Ukraine, at 6.5% fixed rate, which, like, at this point seems like a genius play, because, like, since then, debt costs for copper miners have skyrocketed. So my valuation takes into account the basic scenario, so how much copper they're producing right now. I think I said $8,000 per ton, which is more or less what it's trading right now.
Yeah.
And I take into account the fact that they have a net working capital, but it's really small, so it's like a really not relevant for their valuation. Mm-hmm. And I take the P/E ratio of the major copper miner ETF, which at the time was, I think, 16 times earnings. Mm-hmm. Even though Ero Copper trades at 20 times earnings, I think, right now. And at that point, yeah, like with current copper prices, Ero Copper has an upside of like 200%. Like, it's pretty, It's pretty good, like in terms of a margin of safety.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, like in looking at your, kind of estimates, you've got anywhere from, call it, the upside is 220% to 759%. So walk us through the 759% scenario and how that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible if copper prices double. I mean, which is a big if, right? That said, copper miners like Robert Friedland, the owner of Ivanhoe Mines, says that that is actually the incentive price. Like, that is the price that copper miners need to actually bring good projects into production. And that makes sense for me. Like, if you look at new projects like Filo Mining, with their Filo del Sol project in Argentina. I mean, those guys are going to need $15,000 a ton to produce copper. I mean, it's one of the most, like, even though it's an incredible project, like in terms of grade, in terms of size, it's incredibly difficult to operate. Like, it's up in the mountains, it's super deep. So yeah, like, I think the scenario is realistic. Like, at some point we're gonna get $15,000 dollars per ton in copper prices. The thing about Ero Copper is that I don't need those prices to get a massive upside. That's what I like about this company. Like, they have a cost of production so low that is realistic. So what is baked in into that 700% is that they're gonna double production, which I think is very realistic as well, considering the management team, which took the company public in 2016, I think, in 2015, 2016, has been able to build from scratch a massive copper miner in Brazil. And Brazil isn't particularly famous for copper production. So in a country where copper production isn't actually a thing, this management team has been able to build a low cost, low emission producer, miner in Brazil. That said, they have also built a gold mine from scratch. They bought the NX gold mine when it had 0 years left of mine life, and now it has a mine life up until 2026, and I'm certain that they're gonna extend that mine life further on. And this gold mine has a cost of like $1,000 per ounce, which is,
Wow.
yeah. So with 50,000, even though they produce little, they produce like 50,000 ounces per year. You know, that is $50 million dollars in free cash flow per year.
Is that an all-in sustaining cost number, or is
Yeah.
that cash cost? Wow.
Yeah, that is an all-in sustaining cost, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's wild. And yeah, I'm looking, part of this is, let's say gold gets to 15,000 per ton, the profits from this business jump from, and this is profits after tax, assuming 18% tax, profits jump from 307 million to 824 million. And the
Yeah.
market cap on this company is, I think I just checked, it's like 1.8 billion. Yeah, 1.9 billion.
That is US dollars, right?
Let me check here. I'm on Coinfin. Yeah, Canadian is 2.54
Yeah.
billion CAD. Yeah, I mean it's attractive. And the other thing I like about them is, and it looks like they issued a little bit of stock from September to December of last year. It looks like shares outstanding went from 93 million to 103 million, but before
Yeah.
that, you have little dilution. I mean, it looks like it's like a constant stream of just small dilution, but nothing too crazy. I mean, has management come out and said something along the lines of, "Hey, we're going to buy back some stock, or we're going to pay these special dividends if copper prices, start going higher and they're generating excess profits?"
No, I was listening to the conference they had with investors in March the 7th, I think it was. And no, like there was no talk about like buybacks or dividends. And honestly, like I think at this point, I think that makes sense. I think the management team since 2016 is focused on creating a tier one miner, and it's really difficult to do that in the mining business, giving out dividends. I think their target is to create a Brazil focused miner that is going to be the target of a big takeover from miners like Barrick or Newman Mining.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Did you ever look at Ivanhoe Mines, IVN? I know you mentioned Friedland, and IVN's one of those stocks where I've looked at it and I've told myself, I said, I'm just going to wait for a pullback and then I'm going to buy. And I haven't really gotten the pullback. I mean, I guess in June 2022, there was a pretty decent pullback there, but I've just been on the sidelines while seems like Friedland and that team are executing phenomenally.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately for me, I read The Big Score, the book, when I was like 22, so that was like 4 years ago. I'm 26 now. I mean, it's a great book for any of your listeners that it's interested in this business. Like, I highly recommend it. And from The Big Score, I learned that basically Friedland is a marketing genius. As an example, back in the day, he was the CEO of this Namibian company that said that they could mine diamonds from the sea floor, just like sending like scuba divers down there with like vacuum cleaners and picking up diamonds in the sea floor. Like he made like story out of it, and needless to say, it was a massive failure. I mean, he's a marketing guy. He's not like a technical guy, and in that sense, I never really trusted him. Since then, I have learned that marketing is possibly the number one thing in this business. So yeah, what do I have to say about Ivanhoe? It's a pity that I didn't invest. I would invest now. I think like it's almost everything that is going to happen to them is already baked into the stock price. Possibly if you're really, really bullish in the PGM space, that would make sense to buy into Ivanhoe because they have a really good PGM project. But that said, I think other names like Sibanye make a lot more sense.
It's funny you mention the marketing aspect because for a generalist investor like myself, and I don't know if I would consider you a generalist investor or not, but for generalist investors, when they see a CEO or they see someone like that, not pumping the stock, but actively marketing their company or their project, I think the initial gut reaction is disgust. Like, oh, like why are they doing that? If the project was so good, if the company was so good, they wouldn't need to do that. They would just keep their head down and execute. And like on one hand, that's true. But one thing I've learned about mining stocks or really any sort of extractive industry company is you need to sell your story because financing is so expensive. And it's so expensive to get a bank to loan. It's so expensive to do private placements. It's expensive for streaming and royalties. And you need that story to resonate with the common shareholder so that you can actually do the things that you want to do. And it's just much different than a traditional non-extractive business that has easier accesses to financing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I wouldn't even say the cost of financing is the most important thing. Like, if you look at a company like Uranium Energy Corp, these guys have been accused of spending more money on marketing than on exploration.
Oh, I saw one. They like sponsored a Formula One driver. I think I even commented about that on Twitter. I was like, this is hilarious.
Yeah. In fact, one short seller came out and they were saying, yeah, we're massively short on Uranium Energy Corp because they're spending more money on marketing than on exploration or on research. And my answer to that is that, hey, like, these guys have a higher market cap than, let's say, Energy Fuels. Even though Energy Fuels has better assets, they own the only uranium mill in the United States. And yet UEC has had much better returns. And the reason for that is all this marketing has enabled them to become the prime name in uranium stocks when it comes to the US. So whenever anyone in the US wants to get exposure to US uranium, the first name that comes to mind is UEC. No one thinks of Energy Fuels. And for a long time, since 2017, I have seen this gap in market cap in between UEC and Energy Fuels. And I always thought, hey, like, at some point, the market is going to realize Energy Fuels is a lot more valuable than UEC. And since then, it has only increased.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the returns that UEC are incredible. Marketing is key.
So how do you differentiate between successful marketing and manipulative marketing? And I know that that's a huge gray area, right? Because how do you distinguish between promotional and pumping slash fraudulent? But from the company, like, take, for example, uranium that you invested in from 2017 to 2021. I'm sure there was a ton of promotion going on, both good and bad, suspect and not. How did you suss out what you thought was honest promotion? Like, hey, we need to get our story out versus we're trying to just sell our stock.
Well, I was lucky enough to invest in uranium in 2017 and not in like 2011 when there were like 400 uranium companies out there.
Yeah.
In 2017, there were, I think, 75 uranium stocks in the world.
Wow.
And I went through all of them one by one. And I invested in 11 of them. From 2017 to 2022, around 25 or 30 of those companies either went bankrupt or changed their business. So the way I looked at it in 2017, 2018, to select those 11 names was, first of all, like, how many years has a CEO been in this business? Like, if you talk to any geologist that has experience in uranium, they'll tell you one thing. They'll tell you that uranium is a different beast. Like, mining uranium is a whole different business from mining gold or mining copper. So you need a guy that has been there for years. I don't know, like, for example, like, if you look at a company like Global Atomic or Energy Fuels, their CEOs have been in the uranium business since they were like 18 or 19. And they were like down there in the mines, like mining uranium sometimes. Like, so from those guys, I believe them. Like, I believe they trust their business, they trust themselves, and they're not trying to sell you a fake story. Another important factor is investor presentations. When I look at an investor presentation in any miner, and let's say the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation is 40 slides long, and 20 of those slides is about the macro thesis of the metals. Like, there's like an alarm ringing in my head.
Interesting.
Because, you know, like, if I'm reading an investor presentation of a really small mining company, like, I know the thesis behind the metal.
That's like a good point.
Yeah. Like, I don't need more information. I want to know what you guys are doing different in that project. So for me, like, that is saying, hey, like, what are you trying to hide from me? And And yeah, like I would say, like those 2 points will help a lot of people like differentiate from the good guys from the bad guys.
How much do you pay attention to share counts and just maybe share dilution? Because one kind of not study, but just thought experiment I've had is I wonder if like the cohort of mining companies with sub whatever 150 million shares perform better over time than the mining companies that have more than 100 million shares or something like that. And basically it's just a way of saying like, you know, hey, if you look at a mining company, like some Australian companies have billions of shares outstanding, like billions would be. Is that something you pay attention to? Is that something you've noticed, even if it's just like a, you know, heuristic pattern that you've recognized where mining companies with really high share counts just don't cut it versus the smaller share count ones?
I haven't really noticed such a thing. What I have noticed after like a lot of pain in, especially in the exploration business, is that it's really important that the explorer itself isn't taking care of the expenses. What I mean by this is that like, I don't know, like if you take a company like Mundoro Capital, it's a really, really small Canadian company. I don't think these guys have issued any shares in 6 years, even though they have a market cap of $10 million and they're doing exploration nonstop. So Mundoro Capital, what they do is that they engage in farming agreements in their projects with large miners like Newcrest, Vale, Rio Tinto, and Rio Tinto will take care of all the expenses in exchange for a piece of the project.
Okay.
I mean, that said, Mundoro Capital in particular hasn't had any good results, but hasn't had bad results either. I think, like, if you look at their five-year graph, they're down like 10%, which for an explorer, it's a miracle. Like for an unsuccessful explorer, that is a miracle. Like really normally is. In exploration, once you miss a couple of times, you fall down 80% in stock price.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that how far you'll go down in terms of market cap? Like you'll look at like the micro 10 million guys?
That is how far I've gone. I don't know if that is how far I will go. That said, I'm no longer interested in exploration plays mostly. I only have maybe two or three names in my portfolio and they're like really small positions.
Yeah.
But yeah, also another important factor to separate the good guys from the bad guys, check out the name of the company. Like some companies just put uranium into their name in the last 12 months. I think that is pretty suspicious. And yeah, I think that is something you should look out for.
Well, that's one of the problems that the lithium industry faced. Like, well, just a year, 12, 18 months ago, is so many companies were changing their names to something lithium-based, or you'd see a mining company or an explorer say, oh, you know, we were drilling for copper or we were drilling for X, but now we're drilling for lithium. And you're starting to see it a little bit, the flip, like with uranium now, where companies are changing from being a lithium producer or a copper producer. Now they're saying, oh, we're going to explore uranium now, which again, I think is just maybe another wrinkle in where we are in the uranium phase. But that is something that's very important, is like, where's the hot money going? Where are these companies chasing? And then on the inverse, what are the mining companies that just stick with what they know through the cycle? And those are the ones that you probably want to back.
Yeah. And even then, like, especially in exploration, like nothing is guaranteed. Like if you look at the company like Forum Energy Metals, these guys have been in the uranium space since before Fukushima in 2011. And yet their stock price has gone down nonstop.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that you need a person running the team that has decades of experience in this sector, and even then, it's not gonna work out nicely all the time. I would say that a small piece of advice would be don't buy explorers expecting leverage to the metal prices. All my multi-baggers, 1,000%, 2,000% returns in uranium stocks were from developers, all of them. I mean, I had four of them, all my explorers were either, I don't know, 200% up, or they were actually down in the cycle.
And so of these developers, and I tend to agree, mainly because as soon as I start looking at explorers, it's so difficult to analyze these things if you're not a geologist or if you're not in the weeds in the geology. I mean, there's a couple people that I can text and say, "Hey, here's a screenshot of these drill results. Like, what do you think?" But producers are more easy to understand because you actually have a business, you have revenue and cost, you can see profits or losses. And when you look back at your multi-baggers, are they all predominantly small tier producers that elevate? Maybe they go from small tier to mid tier, or are they mid tier that get acquired by a larger producer in a roll up?
So my multi-baggers were Global Atomic, Boss Energy, Vimy Resources, and that's it, I think. And oh, and Encore Energy. And none of them were producing uranium. I mean, that is pretty easy to say in the uranium business, because back then, only two companies in the world were producing uranium. I mean, three, if you include Orano from France. So the reason they went up so much is simply that the fact that they had a massive uranium leverage. So at some point, they were going to go into production, and the company and the market knew that. So, for example, in the case of Boss Energy, it went up 2,000%, or maybe even more, I think, at this point. And the market liked it a lot because they're producing uranium now, right now, which is when you want to produce uranium. I think the market right now doesn't really understand what's going on with the producers. I think that producers like Cameco and Kazatomprom, they have messed up. Like, they have, I would say that they have missed the cycle, in terms of contracting. Like, Cameco has sold too much uranium in advance, and even if uranium now spikes, their upside is limited. And yet the market is pricing them, they're gonna go to infinity, basically. So yeah, I mean, explorers, terrible business, and developers, I would say that if you buy them at the right time, you can make a fortune. But the timing is super difficult.
Yeah, and speaking of difficult timing, precious or palladium and platinum group metals have been in a vicious downtrend. I mean, if I just look at Sibanye-Stillwater, which we own, from its peak back in 2022 of March down to where it is today, it's down 80%. With, I mean, and it's just talk about capitulation. So your most recent Substack post, it was titled "Palladium and Platinum: The Dawn of a New Bull Market." So obviously, we know kind of what your bias is here. We know where you think the market's headed, but walk us through this entire PGM thesis and why you think it's so compelling.
Well, like yourself, I have suffered quite a bit in a few PGM stocks. I thought the PGM thesis a year ago was compelling, and I was about to capitulate. I was about to sell off. And then like a few weeks ago, I decided to have another look at the thesis and see how it's going. And what I found out is that deficits are the new normal in the PGM space, especially in platinum, and palladium deficits are starting to get noticed. And even though the market is predicting a surplus in palladium in the palladium market, I think that is impossible. I'm not sure where these research companies take their data. I'm assuming like they're expecting like Nornickel, the Russian producer, to increase production or something like that. But it's impossible that palladium is going to go into a deficit, unless there's a recession, of course. But you know, if there's a recession, all bets are off.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got the what I think is the kind of the biggest anchor that a lot of people think is the automotive demand from EVs and plug-ins and plug-in hybrids. And I think the conventional take here is if we shift to EVs, we're going to use a lot less platinum and palladium. And I think you're starting to see now what's unfolding is a narrative shift in, okay, plug-in hybrids and ICE vehicles are going to be around for a lot longer, which means the need for these metals is going to stay with us longer than we anticipated. And I think Rick Rule, you mentioned him earlier, I just watched a presentation with him this morning. He thinks, you know, the demand for ICE and plug-in hybrids are going to be strong for the next 10 to 15 years, which I tend to agree there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I myself own a hybrid car, and I think they are the future, like not for the next 10 years, but possibly for the next 50 years. I have very little trust in the EV market. I think the EV market 100 years from now is going to probably do great, but there's so much technology to be developed for the EV to be actually functional, like to be useful for the everyday man, and affordable, that is just like unrealistic for me. And as I pointed out in my Substack, the sales for internal combustion engines and hybrid cars are actually increasing, and the sales for EV cars are actually slowing down. Like they're still growing, but the sales growth is slowing down. If you look at countries like Norway, which have spent millions, if not billions of dollars, trying to force their citizens to use electric buses, for example. I mean, when temperature in Norway drops to minus 20 degrees Celsius, they have to park those electric buses and take out the diesel ones. Hmm. Like it's ridiculous. In Moscow, they have put all the buses on an electric engine, except in winter they have to put a diesel engine inside in order to heat the bus. Like it's just absurd. Like many countries suffer from cold temperatures, and in these countries, like EVs make no sense. Not to mention, if I want to go to northern Spain, where I'm from right now, I'm in Madrid. Like there is no chance an EV is going to take me all the way there. I'm going to have to wait half an hour for it to fully charge, and perhaps longer if there is a queue of cars that are already charging at the station.
So we know kind of why these PGM prices have declined, but where's the market now? I mean, obviously you have the majors shutting down mines, putting them on care and maintenance, laying off tons of workers. Where are we in terms of production, where the spot price is below the cost of production, and how do you see these PGM prices shaping up over the next 12 to 18 months? Like, what's gonna cause the price to actually inflect higher? Is it just the deficits are going to expand? Sentiment's going to shift. People are going to realize that ICE cars and plug-ins are needed. What are the main drivers for higher prices?
So on the one hand, you have seen demand for platinum coins and bars disappear. I think at some point that is going to normalize. And when that happens, the deficits for platinum are going to explode. Because historically speaking, there has been very, very strong demand from investors that want to keep platinum in a vault, as many people do with gold and silver. On the other hand, you have the producers. These guys are the uranium miners in 2017.
Yeah.
They have massive amounts of debt. They have employees on payroll, and they're losing money every month, every day. I think the PGM producers have not yet caught up with reality. That is my personal point of view. I think that Sibanye, which has like some of the highest cost of production, especially in the US, I think these guys should close down all the US operations right now. Like, I think they're expecting a rebound tomorrow or the next week on PGM prices. And I don't think, as a serious, like, multi-billion dollar company, I don't think that is a bet you can safely take. Hmm. I think they should, you know, drink the poison pill and, hey, like, here's reality. We need to cut down another 25% of our workforce and put on care and maintenance more mines. And they're not doing it right now. So I think that is gonna. I think that's the market right now. I think the market is not being realistic about the situation of PGMs. I think the Russians are dumping palladium into the market. Although I think that's probably already like done, because there's just so much palladium in the world, right? Like, it's one of the most scarce resources on earth. I think Nornickel is already going to lower PGM production, as they said in their last investor presentation, and possibly we'll see cuts from other miners. And just the other day, I got a comment on my Substack from a gentleman that was asking me about how the new Ivanhoe Mine Platreef PGM project is going to affect the prices of our PGMs.
Yeah.
And I decided to take a look at the mine life of all these giant producers like Impala, like Anglo American. You know, like Impala, they have two big mines. They have one mine called Rustburg that produces 1.2 million ounces a year of PGMs. Like, it's incredible. Yeah. Although that includes gold. And they have a big mine in Canada that they bought a few years ago that produces like 300,000 ounces of PGMs. Those two mines are going to close down in between 2029 and 2035. So even if they continue producing, a lot of these mines are going to run out of ore. And if they do continue producing, they're going to run into bigger losses, which are going to provoke even larger layoffs. And this wasn't a problem for uranium, because uranium is produced mainly in places like Canada or Kazakhstan, which don't have significant social issues. Maybe Kazakhstan does, but it's a dictatorship, so it's a different kind of like game. In the case of PGMs, they have to be really, really careful. South Africa is a place that has seen social strikes for a long time this century. And if they start to lay off a lot of people, they could see a lot of social issues, not to mention the power outages that have been going on since 2007, sorry. And they continue to this day. No one knows how that's going to affect PGM miners.
Yeah. And so you mentioned in the PGM piece, your analysis on generation mining, which I thought was an interesting little situation.
Yeah.
Walk me through that thesis. I mean, it seems straightforward. It's got, you know, a lot of asset value. It's got a decent NPV, and it's trading at a pretty low price.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to start with the bad side of generation mining.
Yeah.
The bad side for me is that they should be sitting down and doing nothing right now. Like, they should be cutting costs. They should be reducing their salaries and preferably like earning their salaries on stock options. Instead of that, they just announced an exploration program around the project. So for me, I mean, that is nonsense. I mean, like, they should be sitting down waiting for the price of palladium to spike. I mean, hopefully they'll find something interesting, because I'm invested in generation mining, unfortunately. I'm down like 70%. But yeah, like, that is the bad side. The good side about generation mining is that they own the largest PGM project in Canada. And I'm not sure if it's larger than the one of Sibanye in Montana, but I'm guessing it's not, because the Sibanye operations in the US are massive. And they have a massive IRR at 26%, I think, but that IRR is at $1,800 palladium. So yeah, like, it's far away from here. The good thing about that project is that they have an all-in cost of production of $800 per palladium ounce. So even at these prices, it's an economic deposit. So as I was showing in the article in my Substack, at these prices, the Marathon project of generation mining has an NPV of over $200 million US, and you know, the market cap is at 40 million US, I think. So the discount is massive. They also have net cash, and they own I think a few hundred thousand shares of Moon River Capital, which just discovered a massive molybdenum deposit in Canada, I think. And that has spiked in price in Moon River. So those shares are actually pretty valuable.
Yeah, and I just kind of love the way you put it in the Substack. You say for a market cap, and this is, you know, the price at the time, for a market cap of 57 million, shareholders get 11 million in net cash, 7 million in publicly traded securities, and 226 million in NPV of the Marathon project at current prices. Yeah. It's pretty interesting value proposition.
Yeah. Not only that, I mean, the CEO has built four or five mining companies, which he has been able to sell all of them to major mining companies. Also, Jamie Levy is a really good CEO. I don't know that much about his background, but I mean, I've heard him in a few conferences, and he's a top tier guy. And what's really interesting is their progress in financing the Marathon project. I mean, I don't know, like, looking back at uranium, you have companies like Fission Uranium that need over $1 billion to finance the project, and they have none of that guaranteed. Like, or NextGen needs like, I don't know, like $2 billion or like $1.5 billion to build the Arrow project. And the good thing about Generation Mining is that they have an agreement with Wheaton Precious Metals for $250 million Canadian in terms of royalty streaming agreements for their gold reserves and 22% of their platinum reserves. And they also made a deal with the Development Bank of Canada, which I didn't even know existed, which together with, I think, Société Générale and other banks are going to provide Generation Mining with around $500 million Canadian in financing. You know, like, these are incredible deals for a company that trades at $50 million market cap. I think that the management team has done great work in doing the financing for this deal.
When you look at these companies and you analyze them on an NPV basis, how do you kind of rank these projects? Because I ask this for two reasons. One, I think you can rank them obviously on a market cap to NPV and see, okay, like, what are they trading relative to their NPV? However, the other one I like to do is the capital needed to extract the NPV, right? So making up numbers, an NPV for a project is $2 billion. A company says they need $1.5 billion. To me, that's not as attractive as an NPV that's $200 million and the company needs $20 to $50 million to finance. So is that something you look for? And then do you have like a filter where, you know, you only really want to invest in companies where the capital or the NPV to capital needed ratio is like 3 or 4 to 1, or is it more just you're looking at the market cap as a percentage of the NPV?
Yeah, like, initial capital to start the mine is really important.
Yeah.
Really important. And in that case, Generation Mining is very unlucky because they're in Canada, and Canada has some of the highest environmental laws in the world, some of the most strict, which forces them to really take care of things in their economic study. That's why they have $1 billion of initial capital needed to start the mine. But the unfortunate thing in mining is that it's a really capital intensive business. So it's really difficult to find a developer that needs little capital to start this. Perhaps in terms of PGMs, the only exception is Ivanhoe. I think they need like $500 million to start the Platreef project, and their NPV is in the billions. Mm-hmm. That said, they are in the DRC, so they don't need as much of an environmental work as someone would need in Canada or in the US. And Platreef is an exceptional project. Like, let's face it. Like if Platreef was a single company, like it was owned by a single company with no other projects, it would be the best PGM play in the world. Unfortunately, Ivanhoe makes most of its money from copper. So I'm not sure how much PGM leverage you're going to get from investing in Ivanhoe at this point.
Unless they do something like they end up spinning it off if PGM prices elevate. Like, I could totally see Friedland doing that as a way to extract.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely, yeah.
Are you looking at any other spaces? We've covered copper. We've covered PGMs. I've been bullish gold for a while. Are you looking in the gold space? Are you looking in precious metals? And if so, where are you finding value?
I think gold is a really interesting space. I'm seeing gold like I was seeing uranium like in 2019, let's say. Like, in 2019, something really interesting happened in uranium. From 2017 to 2019, uranium went up a bit, but uranium stocks were flat or down 50% in that period. So that is what's happening right now in the gold space. Like in the gold space, gold is at least in nominal terms, is at an all-time high. But you have all these producers that are flat, and you have developers that are down 80 to 90% from peaks. So probably the biggest value right now is in the junior developer space. That said, if gold doesn't continue to go up, it's going to be a really, really tough play. These guys are running out of money. The cost of capital is massive, and if gold drops, many of them are going to go broke. So I would say probably the safest thing to do in terms of like gold exposure would be buying something like royalty and streaming companies, perhaps buying the GDX ETF. I also like a company called A-Mark Precious Metals, which works in terms of like as a broker in terms of like keeping gold at vaults. Another really interesting company is Gold Money.
Is that XAU? That's the ticker, XAU.
Sorry?
The ticker for that for Gold Money is XAU, right? Just making sure.
I'm not sure. It's been a while since I checked that company.
Okay, let me look it up. Yeah, okay, yeah, XAU. It trades on
Yeah,
the TSX.
XAU.
Yep.
They have a really interesting business in terms of they're a gold broker, but they also offer services to keep gold, silver, platinum, palladium in vaults all over the world. They used to have a deal with Peter Schiff, the gold bug. Unfortunately, they broke that deal. I think that's unfortunate for Gold Money. But yeah, I think it's an interesting company, and it's pretty much at an all-time low, I think, right now. They have like net working capital of like $120 million or something like that. Like it's like they have no debt, albeit like it's a terrible business. Like the net profit on margin is like 1%.
Yeah, they made. Let's see, total revenue was 320 million, 321 million, and they made 6.7 million in profit.
Yeah,
So,
2% net margin. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. It's
But,
a.
I mean, they're buying back stock, it looks like. And you're right. Like, I'm looking at their assets. They've got, and this is in Canadian dollars. So they've got 40 million in cash. They've got 53 million in precious metals. And they've got 2.2 million in marketable securities, another million in receivables. So call it, I don't know, close to 90 million in current assets. And they have 4 million in total liabilities, which is all from accounts payable. That's not
Like,
bad.
it's a really cash heavy balance sheet, and precious metals are really liquid. Those marketable securities is really interesting. It's a company called Mene, MENE. It trades in the stock market, and they sell like bracelets and are other kind of like items with like gold and silver, kind of for like the jewels and stuff. So yeah, like they're trying to cover like different areas of the gold market, but so far it's gone really bad.
Yeah, this is, I mean, the share price, you can tell it's from 2021, it's down from 19, $20 to $7. So, but no, I mean, like I think these ideas are interesting. I mean, I think you mentioned it earlier where, if gold reverses here and trades a lot lower, a lot of these companies are going to get crushed. And I agree, which is why I think, like, again, if you're going to play in the space, like I'm trying to focus on these small to mid-tier producers that are generating a lot of cash flow and have said either through, like through earnings transcripts or through their history, that they're returning cash via buybacks or dividends. And I think to me, like, that's the most important thing with this cycle is, if you're going to play it, to play it with these producers that actually return cash to you, regardless of whatever the market multiple is or whatever investors think the business should trade at.
Yeah. For example, like, I don't know if you saw it on my Twitter account. Back on 2019, I did a research project where I got a list of every single royalty and streaming company in the world. And I did a back test back to 2005, from 2005 to 2019, looking at a hypothetical ETF built only with royalty and streaming companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that if you only invest in royalty and streaming companies, these guys have beaten the S&P 500 without even taking dividends into account.
Yeah.
Yeah, like royalty and streaming companies, like, it's definitely a good place to be in. In that sense, I think small ones are really good. Like, if you, if you're like a veteran in the space and you're familiar with this, and you can get comfortable with the risk, I think small royalties are the place to be right now in the gold space.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, the greatest business model ever. Basically, it's, you just, yeah, like, you put a little bit of money in and you get a return stream with basically an infinite payout timeline, and you have almost no overhead. You make like 90-80% margins.
Yeah, like, for example, like, there's this company called Origen Royalties, Origen Royalties, which, okay, I'm a shareholder of. These guys own a royalty which is worth approximately like $150 million, which is already like their market cap. And, you know, it's a property that is going to have like 8-10 million ounces of gold, massive deposit. So it's going to be producing gold for decades. So yeah, like, as you said, it's the best business model ever. I mean, it's incredible. Like, it's the unfortunate situation of the mining business, right? Like, it's so capital intensive that they need any source of capital and financing that they can use.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, you know, look, royalty and streaming contracts aren't super cheap, but when you go to a bank, if you're a small mining company and you ask for a loan, they either tell you we can't because of ESG restrictions, or sure, but it's going to be 18-22%.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like, issuing debts, issuing shares nowadays is going to cost you like 10%. So yeah, they much rather issue shares and dilute shareholders out of their property.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alberto, so yeah, this has been super fun, man. I appreciate you taking the time to walk me through Ero Copper, Palladium and Platinum, and even discussing some precious metals. I want to end the conversation with just your thoughts on where you want your Substack to be, why you decided to write online, and maybe any ideas that you've got for future Substack posts.
Yeah, my investing philosophy is very much the one of an asymmetrical bet. So if it was a coin flip, heads, I win a lot. Tails, I lose a little, if anything. In terms of that, I don't believe there's a risk-reward proportion. Like, I don't think that exists at all. I think you can get exposed to massive upside with little risk. And that is what I'm trying to search. I'm searching for really special situations, asymmetrical opportunities. And going forward, I'm going to look for them either in the mining space or elsewhere. For example, this week, I'm planning on either this week or next week, I'm planning on publishing a report on the UK, on the situation there, They're entering a recession, and I have found a company that can actually profit from recessions in the UK. So for me, that's kind of the thing. Like, if there's a recession, this company is going to make a lot of money. If there's not, they still have like a solid business model. So yeah, that's it.
Got it. I love it. And what's the name of the Substack so people can go find it?
Yeah, it's Alberto's Substack.
Awesome. And it's albertoag.substack.com. And yeah, we connected on Twitter. So where can people go to find you on Twitter?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at AAG Research.
Awesome. And then the last question I ask every guest, Alberto, is if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Oof, that's a difficult one. It could be dead.
Yeah, anybody, past or present, could be dead, could be science fiction. It's totally your call.
I would say it's Isaac Newton.
I like that one.
And the reason why, I mean, that dude, like, by the time he was 21, he discovered calculus, he rediscovered geometry, optics, and, you know, for a 21-year-old, that is quite a lot. And then he spent, like, 40 years, like, researching the Bible and, like, alchemy and stuff. And he made this really, like, ridiculous prediction. He, like, if I read it correctly back in the day, already 300 years ago, he said that in 1948, the suffering of the Jews would end. And in 1948, Israel was founded. I mean, that is pretty scary if you think about it. So, yeah, like, I would love to have dinner with that guy and, you know, like, know what kind of guy he was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great answer. And, thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate you doing it and love to have you back on again whenever you've got some more ideas, to discuss. And I hope you get a lot more Substack followers, and I hope you get a pretty decent bump in your Twitter following, because you produce a lot of high quality content. And I just hope people kind of realize that through this conversation. So thanks again so much, Alberto. Have a great rest of the year, and good luck in all these PGMs and copper and commodities.
Thank you. Good luck to you too. Thank you for having me.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, marhelm.com, to get your discount today. This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.